This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Fortune and Glory, a Stephanie Plum novel, Book 27, by Janet Ivanovich. Read by Lorelei King.
For Carolyn Reedy, a remarkable lady who was always a champion for me and Stephanie. Chapter 1. My name is Stephanie Plum, and I'm a fugitive apprehension agent in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm not especially brave, so you would think I'd pretty much stay out of trouble. Unfortunately, I occasionally ignore the obvious signs of danger and stumble into something ugly with the potential for disaster. This was one of those times. I was in a tunnel under a strip club, and I was with my coworker, Lula.
"This is a bad idea," Lula said to me. "My nipples are all shrunk up and trying to hide inside my body. It's like what men's gonads do when someone comes at them with a butcher knife. Those suckers abandon ship and there's nothing left but an empty nutsack. Not that I know firsthand. I'm just saying what I hear."
Aside from being a bounty hunter, I think I'm pretty normal. I have shoulder-length, curly brown hair that's usually pulled back into a ponytail, blue eyes from my mother's Hungarian ancestors, and a bunch of rude hand gestures from my father's Italian side of the family. My nipples aren't as smart or nearly as big as Lula's. They were currently snug inside my sports bra, going along for the ride and not paying attention to much of anything.
"Not only that, but I think my hair's standing on end," Lula said. "Look at it. Is it standing on end? It feels like it. My scalp is all tingly. That's a for sure sign that something horrible is going to happen to us."
Lula's hair is always a surprise. Some days it's lavender. Some days it's braided. Some days it isn't even Lula's real hair. Today it was a massive puffball of chemically induced black ringlet shot through with hot pink highlights and sprinkled with glittery tiny pink stars. It was awesome. The rest of Lula is equally awesome, as her bounty runneth over in booty and boob and everything else. Today she was packed into a yellow spandex mini bandage dress that was sized for a much, much smaller woman. I was in my usual uniform of sneakers, jeans, and girly t-shirt. Lula and I were playing hooky from bounty huntering to track down Luis Augusta, a mob guy who specializes in information extraction and revenge by barbecuing various body parts of his victims. He's one of six hitmen who, years ago, bought a strip club called the Molehole. It's located in downtown Trenton, and it's famous for its cheap drinks, outstanding burgers, and mob-occupied back room. It was common knowledge that the six club owners each had a personal Lazy Boy recliner in the back room, and the possession of one of those recliners was as good as, if not better than, being made. Recently, Salgusta and one of his Lazy Boy pals, Charlie Shine, decided my grandmother had the key to a treasure. They kidnapped Grandma and me, and while we endured some terrifying moments, we were able to escape with minimum damage. Problem is, Shine and Salgusta still want the key to the treasure. And we saw them murder a man in cold blood while we were captive. So there's incentive for Salgusta and Shine to capture us again, persuade Grandma to give them the key, and then kill us.
"I know it's a righteous undertaking to protect your granny," Lula said, "but we aren't exactly that diehard guy."
"John McClane?"
"No, Bruce Willis. I'm guessing you don't even have a gun. I'm guessing your gun is home in your brown bear cookie jar."
She was right about the gun, and she was right about us not being Bruce Willis. Unfortunately, I can't let any of that stop me, because I love my grandma, and I will do whatever it takes to protect her. And as I see it, the only way to protect her is to track down Salgusta and Shine and get them behind bars. 20 minutes ago, I got a call from my mom, who'd gotten a call from Margie Wisneski, who'd gotten a call from her alcoholic brother that he was having his mid-morning pick-me-up at the Molehole, and that Luis Augusta had just walked in and gone straight to the back room. Lula and I rushed to the scene, but the back room was empty when we arrived. Margie's brother was still at the bar and swore that Augusta went into the back room and didn't come out.
"There's got to be a secret way out of that room," Lula said. That's the way it always is in the gangster movies. You've got to have a way to sneak out when the bulls show up. That's what they used to call the police. I know all about this because I got the Classics Movie Channel on my TV package.
We returned to the back room and looked around. 6 Lazy Boy chairs, a monster safe, a card table with 4 folding chairs, big screen TV, no windows or doors other than the door opening to the barroom. After several minutes of searching, we found a trap door hidden under a rug. We opened the door, climbed down a ladder, and stood squinting in the dim light of an escape tunnel that was approximately 6 feet high and 3 feet wide. It was encased in concrete and lit by a single bulb that was about 30 feet in front of the ladder. Lula and I were now standing under that bulb. The tunnel changed from concrete to dirt at this point. It was supported by wood posts at regular intervals, and it narrowed slightly.
"I'm going back," Lula said. "No way in hell am I going to squeeze myself into that dirt tunnel. First off, it's going to smudge up my dress, and second, it's a tunnel to death and doom."
"I imagine you got the death and doom message from your nipples."
"Don't underestimate my nipples. I got nipple radar. When they talk, I listen."
Lula turned and huffed back to the ladder. She climbed the ladder and stopped at the top.
"This here door's closed," she said.
"You followed me down. Did you close the door?"
"Yeah, I didn't want anyone to know we were down here. I didn't count on it being so hard to get open again."
"Maybe there's a latch somewhere, a button to push," I said.
"I'm feeling all around and I don't see no button."
"Are you sure you can't push the door open?"
"Would I be standing here on this freaking ladder if I could get the freaking door open?" Lula said.
I replaced Lula on the ladder and tried the door. No luck. I climbed down the ladder and pulled my cell phone out of my pocket. No bars. I looked down the corridor at the dark, dirt tunnel of death and doom.
"Guess what?" I said. "I don't like guess what, and I don't like the way this place smells," Lula said, following me to the end of the concrete.
"It smells like dirt."
"Exactly," Lula said. "There's no other smells besides dirt, and that would indicate that we're underground with no windows or anything, like we're in a tomb. You see what I'm saying?"
"We aren't in a tomb. We're in a tunnel that Luz Augusta just used, so it has to go somewhere." Okay. Truth is, I was every bit as creeped out as Lula. I didn't like being underground. It was claustrophobic. The air was heavy with dirt and damp, and I had to keep reminding myself that I wasn't suffocating. Even worse was the thought that Luz Augusta might be waiting at the other end. I wanted to capture him, but I wasn't confident that I could do it under these circumstances. I tapped my phone's flashlight app. "Stay close behind me and don't use your phone," I said to Lula. "We should save your battery."
"Do you want my gun, being that you're first in line?"
"Sure." I took the gun from her, not so much for self-defense as to make sure Lula didn't panic and accidentally shoot me in the back. We walked a short distance, and the tunnel curved. The single light bulb disappeared from view, and there was only blackness in front of us and behind us.
"I can't see what I'm walking on," Lula said. "It feels squishy, and I hear water dripping."
Water was dripping from the top of the tunnel, and the dirt underfoot was muddy. I could see men's footprints in the mud. Augusta, I thought. Maybe someone else. Hard to tell in the dark. The tunnel came to a T-intersection. I flashed the light in both directions and saw nothing but endless, dark tunnel. I went right, following the footprints.
"There's something dropped on my neck," Lula said. "I can feel it crawling. It's one of them big tarantulas. Lord help me, I got them all over me."
I turned and flashed the light on Lula. "I don't see anything. I think you're just getting dripped on."
"It was on me, and then it jumped off."
I directed the light to the ground, and a small rat scurried away.
"Holy hell," Lula said.
I bit into my lip to keep from screaming and moved forward.
"I bet there's snakes up ahead," Lula said. "That's the way it is with Indiana Jones. First the tarantulas and rats and then the snakes. Where's the end of this freaking tunnel? I want to see the light. Where the heck is the light?"
"Hang on," I said. "I'm following footprints."
"I think we must be coming to the end because I smell something different," Lula said. "It doesn't smell like just dirt anymore. It smells like kerosene or gasoline or something."
I'd noticed the smell when we turned the corner a while back.
I didn't think it was a good sign since we were following a man whose best friend was an acetylene torch.
"What's those red dots in front of us?"
Lula asked. I flashed the light at the dots. "Rats," I said.
"Shoot 'em!"
I wasn't going to waste bullets on rats. I was saving them for whatever more horrible, more ferocious creatures might be lurking in the dark. Alligators, or a slimy mud monster, or Luz Augusta. I saw a flicker of light far down the tunnel. Another flicker eerily illuminated a smiling face, and whoosh, the face disappeared behind a curtain of fire. Flames licked at the ground in front of a monstrous fireball and raced toward us. I turned and shoved Lula. "Run!" We ran blind in the dark, my flashlight beam bouncing around. A swarm of rats were also running for their lives, squealing beside us. I stepped on one and kicked another out of the way. Lula was huffing and puffing in front of me. "Run faster," I yelled. "I've got a wall of fire behind me." We reached the intersection, made the turn, and the fire roared past us. We were bent over, catching our breath, and I thought I heard footsteps far off in one of the tunnels. "We need to get to the trapdoor," I said to Lula. "Get moving."
"What happens when we get to the trapdoor?" Lula asked.
"We open it." The dirt was dry underfoot in this part of the tunnel, and the single bulb was visible in front of us. We passed under the light, and I stared up at the wood door.
"Stand back," I said to Lula.
I emptied the clip into the door where I thought the latch was located. The door was pocked with rounds, and I could see through a couple of holes I drilled in the wood. I climbed the ladder and pushed, but the door didn't budge. I heard the scuff of shoes and muffled speech. I banged on the door and yelled for help. The trapdoor was wrenched open, and a young guy in a black mohole t-shirt looked down at me.
"What the heck?"
he said, taking my hand, helping me out. Lula was right behind.
"No kidding, what the heck," she said. "You gotta fix that door. Bad enough you got a creep-ass tunnel down there, but your door don't even work when you want to get out. I got ruined via Spigas, and I gotta take this dress to the cleaners. You know how much they charge to clean a dress? And, on top of that, there's fireballs and rats down there, and I'm pretty sure I got the rat cooties on me."
She tugged her skirt down over her ass and looked at the guy who helped me out.
"You're the bartender, right? I want one of them man-eater burgers with extra fries and a Chardonnay."
"Not a good idea," I said. "There might be someone following us, and I'm out of bullets."
"Yeah, but I really need a burger," Lula said. "I'm about having a heart attack. I need something to calm myself. I need meat and grease and cheese."
I could identify. My blood pressure was just a couple of notches below stroke level, but a burger wasn't going to do it for me. I wanted to get out of the molehole. I needed air. I needed distance from the smiling face of Luz Augusta. "We can get a burger on the way to the office," I said. I looked at the bartender. "Thanks for the help. We appreciate it."
"Yeah, no problem. I wouldn't have heard the gunshots, but the music shut off between sets."
He looked down at the open trap door.
"I didn't know there was a tunnel."
I turned to go and almost bumped into a woman who was standing behind me. She was my height and about my age. She was exotically pretty, with long brown hair and large almond-shaped eyes. She was dressed in black, black Louboutin combat boots with signature spikes covering the toes, black skinny jeans, black tank top with a black Loro Piana traveler jacket. Her lipstick was perfectly outlined, just like her eyes.
"Did I hear you say there was a tunnel?" she asked.
"This here is a tunnel from hell," Lula said.
The woman moved closer and studied the ladder.
"What's down there?"
"Mostly mud and rats," I said.
"Interesting," she said. "A tunnel under a strip club. If you excuse me, I think I'll investigate."
"And fire," I said. "Did I mention the fire?" She was already halfway down the ladder. "Hey," I yelled at her. "The tunnel is dangerous. You shouldn't be exploring down there." She disappeared from view, her boots echoing on the concrete for a short time, and then there was silence. "Do you know her?" I asked the bartender.
"Never saw her before," he said.
"She's not from Jersey," Lula said.
She doesn't talk right. She sounds like Eliza Doolittle. And she's a crazy lady, but she got good taste in purses. She had a Fendi mini backpack hanging from her shoulder. I always wanted one of them.
Lula and I were splattered with mud and smelled of gasoline. We left the back room, walked through the dimly lit barroom, and went out the door. We stood blinking in the bright sunlight.
I need to get out of these clothes before I got spontaneous combustion going on, Lula said.
Chapter 2. I dropped Lula off at the bail bonds office on Hamilton Avenue. Her car was parked at the curb, and my cousin Vinny's Cadillac was parked behind her. Vinny's name is on the storefront sign, Vincent Plum Bail Bonds, and on some more or less official papers, it looks like Vinny owns the business. Truth is, his father-in-law, Harry the Hammer, owns the business, and he also owns Vinny. Traffic was light, allowing me to do the drive from the bail bonds office to my apartment building in less than 15 minutes. I had the windows open, hoping the gasoline smell wouldn't linger in the upholstery. I was driving a blue Honda CR-V that wasn't brand new, but it was new to me. I live in a boring but adequately maintained three-story apartment building on the outskirts of Trenton proper. My one-bedroom apartment is on the second floor and looks out at the parking lot. It's not a scenic location, but it's quiet, with the exception of the dumpster collection twice a week. I share the apartment with a hamster named Rex. He lives in an aquarium on my kitchen counter, and he sleeps in a soup can. Until very recently, I sometimes shared the apartment with an on-again, off-again boyfriend, Joe Morelli. He's a plainclothes Trenton cop working crimes against persons. Our relationship is currently in the off-again stage, so these days it's just me and Rex. Rex is mostly a nighttime kind of guy, but he peeked out of his soup can when I walked into the kitchen. "Here's the deal," I said to Rex. "I didn't find Charlie Shine, but I did find his partner, Lou. He tried to set me on fire, and he got away, but as you can see, I'm perfectly okay, except for my sneakers that smell like gasoline." Rex retreated into his den, so I assumed he didn't feel compelled to know the details of my ordeal. I dropped an apple slice into his food dish, and I tossed the sneakers into the trash. I needed new ones anyway. My parents live a couple of blocks from the bail bonds office in a residential chunk of Trenton called the Burg. I grew up in the Burg, and I feel comfortable there, but it's not where I want to live. The Burg is a lot like Rex's glass aquarium, small and enclosed and open for everyone to see in. I can't get away from my past in the Burg. Not that my past is so terrible. It's more that I'd like to be judged on my future, whatever that might be. Since I don't have a good grip on my future, I'm stuck in the Burg and its surrounding neighborhood, which is another way of saying I'm halfway to who knows where. My parents still live in the house where I grew up. It's a small house on a small lot. The house is painted mustard yellow and brown, not because anyone likes the colors, but because it costs too much money to change. There are three small bedrooms upstairs plus a bathroom. Living room, dining room, and kitchen downstairs. Narrow front porch running the width of the house. Small stoop in the back off the kitchen door. Single car detached garage. My maternal grandmother lives in the house, too. She moved in when my grandpa Mazur succumbed to years of schnitzel and Marlboros and took up residence in heaven. At least we hope it's heaven. She was at the front door when I parked at the curb, possibly checking the weather or maybe experiencing a moment of grandma ESP that told her I was driving down the street.
"Just in time for lunch," she said when I walked up to the house. "It's Monday, so that means leftover roast chicken. Your mother made it into chicken salad, and we have little rolls from the bakery."
Food is important in the Burg. It's the glue that holds everything together. News travels through the bakery and the deli. Bread is blessed at the church. Charities are funded at bake sales. Families still sit at the table for dinner whether they like it or not. Adult children are bribed into visiting their parents with the promise of pineapple upside-down cake, lasagna, fried chicken and biscuits, Virginia baked ham.
Cultural appropriation is a good thing here. Polish housewives share recipes with their Italian neighbors. Kielbasa, macaroni and red sauce, cosido a portuguesa, enchiladas, burgers, goulash, pot roast, pierogi, pad thai, we eat it all. The American melting pot is alive and healthy in Berg kitchens. Even death prompts an outpouring of food. Liquor flows at the after-burial reception, and the buffet table holds a disturbing number of noodle casseroles. My father was in his chair in front of the television in the living room. He's retired from the post office and drives a cab part-time, mostly taking a few regulars to and from the train station. He had a sandwich and a soda on a tray table, and he was tuned in to QVC. Grandma and I tiptoed around him and joined my mother in the kitchen.
"I'm glad you're here," my mother said to me. "Your grandmother is talking crazy again about going off on a treasure hunt. You have to speak to her. She won't listen to me."
At some point in time, my mother and grandmother reversed roles. My mother is now the voice of maturity and reason, and my grandmother is the rebellious family member who is happy to throw caution to the wind and dye her hair flame red.
"They aren't crazy ideas," Grandma said. "And that treasure is my legitimate inheritance. My honey Jimmy left it to me. He was keeper of the Lazy Boy's keys, and he left the two keys to me."
"He didn't leave the keys to you," my mother said. "He put them under his chair cushion. He died. One of his mob buddies stupidly gave you the chair, and by dumb luck, we found the keys. And now I'm left with that horrible chair in my living room."
The chair was Jimmy's ancient moho Lazy Boy recliner. My father loved it.
"Anyway, Stephanie promised she would help me find my treasure," Grandma said.
"Whatever the keys unlock belongs to the six men named on the keys, not just to Jimmy," my mother said. "He was only one of the six Lazy Boys."
The two keys appeared to be identical and weren't normal house keys. They were 5 inches long with a slim barrel handle. Double-sided teeth were cut into one end of the handle, and a 1-inch square was at the other end. The names of the 6 Lazy Boy owners were engraved in the square. We checked with Google and determined that the keys most likely opened a safe.
"I get his share of the treasure," Grandma said. "It doesn't matter we were only married for 45 minutes before he had the heart attack. His will said I got just about everything. And on top of that, there's only 3 of the people named on the keys that are still alive, and 2 of them are going to jail for murder as soon as Stephanie can find them. The 3rd is Benny the Scooch, and he's not in good shape."
This was all true. 3 of the Lazy Boy owners had died, and their chairs remained unoccupied in the back room. 2 of the remaining mob guys, Luis Augusta and Charlie Shine, were wanted for the murder Grandma and I witnessed. Charlie Shine was also in violation of a bail bond Vinny had written on him over a year ago. I hung my messenger bag on the back of a kitchen chair. I got a plate and a knife and fork and took my place at the small square table. Grandma sat next to me, and my mom sat across from me.
"I think the treasure is here in Jersey," Grandma said, taking a roll. "I can't see them putting it far away. I did some checking, and it's not like any of the 6 men were world travelers. What we have to do now is find the safe that goes with the keys."
"That sort of safe usually has a combination lock that works in conjunction with the keys," I said, "and we don't know the combination."
"Yes, but you got Ranger," Grandma said, "and Ranger knows how to open everything."
Ranger is the other man in my life. His given name is Carlos Minoso, but he goes by Ranger. He's former Special Forces, former bounty hunter, and on a few memorable occasions, I've slept in his bed. He currently owns Rangeman, a high-end, under-the-radar security firm. And Grandma is right. Nothing stops Ranger when he wants entry. I made myself a chicken salad sandwich and took some potato chips from the bag on the table. "Do you have any ideas about where this safe might be located besides New Jersey?" I asked Grandma.
"Not exactly," Grandma said, "but I got a lot of feelers out, and I'm doing what you said about not telling anyone I found the keys. I'm just making it sound like I'm curious."
"This is stupid," my mother said to Grandma. You're going to get kidnapped again. Salgusta and Shine are going to burn our house down. You need to get rid of the keys. If you don't want to give them to Salgusta or Shine, you should give them to Benny. Maybe he'll give you some of the treasure.
No way, Grandma said. But I'll hand some of the treasure over to Benny when I find it, being that he's the one who was nice enough to give me Jimmy's old chair. I was thinking Stephanie should talk to him, and maybe he'll spill the beans about the safe. He's on a lot of meds. He might not know he's given up the secret.
I had to give credit to Grandma. She was a master schemer. And she could be right about Benny. He was in his golden years that weren't entirely golden. He had heart issues and weight issues. It took two wise guys to get him out of his lazy boy. He was on prescribed meds and, I suspected, recreational meds. Not to mention he liked a good cigar and never passed up a glass of whiskey. The names on the keys were all geriatric or dead hitmen who were mostly okay guys when they weren't whacking someone. This was true about Benny.
I hear Benny is at home all depressed, Grandma said. He used to meet up with all his cronies at the molehole, but now they're either dead or hiding out. He'd probably be happy to have a visitor. I could even go with you. I'm real clever at worming information out of people.
My mother did an eye roll and made the sign of the cross. I'll stop in after lunch, I said to Grandma. I'll go alone this time. If I can't get anything out of him, we'll bring you in next time.
Sounds like a plan, Grandma said. I have stuff to do anyway. I have follow-up phone calls to make. Jean Molinowski said her nephew was a pit boss at one of the casinos in Atlantic City, and he told her that Jimmy was a regular. Her nephew is checking to see if Jimmy gave a local address. We're thinking he might have kept a second apartment there.
Originally, I thought I'd be pretty good at finding a treasure. After all, my real job is finding people and dragging them back to jail. People, treasure, what's the difference other than the payoff? Finding skips has me living paycheck to paycheck if I'm lucky. My thinking is the treasure has to be worth a lot more. Unfortunately, it's also turning out to be more difficult to find. When I go after people, I already have a file full of clues assembled by the bond agency. Home addresses, work addresses, names of relatives, a picture. In the case of the treasure, I have to go find the clues before I can put it all together and actually go on the hunt. Then there's a danger factor. Most of my skips are dangerous, but not usually at the same level as Shine and Salgusta. Grandma and I were lucky to survive our last encounter with them. And I was pretty certain the only thing keeping Grandma and me alive and untortured up to this point is that Shine and Salgusta can't figure out how to snatch us. They used to have a bunch of wise guys working for them in the past, but not lately. And if they confided their plans to the wrong person, it would spread like wildfire through the burg. It would be told to the second cousin of a first niece of a friend's brother who goes to church with his butcher's son, who happens to be a cop. This could result in not only jail time, but also no treasure for Shine and Salgusta. So I'm thinking they're being careful right now. But it's only a matter of time before they come after us.
Chapter 3.
I stopped at the bakery and got a box of freshly filled cannoli. If there's one thing a cardiac patient craves, it's full-fat ricotta cheese and deep-fried pastry. Steak and fried onion rings would be a second. I drove to Benny's house and parked at the curb. A purple Kia was in the driveway. Benny's wife Carla had late-stage Parkinson's, and I thought the Kia probably belonged to Carla's caregiver. I rang the bell, a young woman answered, and I told her I'd come to talk to Benny.
Who's there?
Benny yelled from another room. Stephanie Plum, I yelled back.
He's watching television in the den, the woman said. Just walk straight back.
The den was a small room that had been tacked onto the living room. Benny was wedged into a club chair positioned in front of a large flat-screen TV. A leather recliner was next to him. A tiger-striped cat was curled up in the recliner. Benny smiled when he saw me, his eyes instantly focusing on the white bakery box. Cannoli, I said.
You're gonna kill me, he said. Are they fresh filled?
Of course.
Hand them over, he said. You want one?
No, I just had lunch at my mother's house. I looked at the cat. I'm guessing the cat is in your chair. Benny took a cannoli out of the box.
Yeah, he's an old guy. I don't like to disturb him when he's sleeping.
I heard you weren't going to the molehole anymore.
None of the guys are there, he said. It's not the same. And I hear it smells like dead rat roast.
This tells me that Benny is getting some real-time reporting from someone at the molehole. I followed Luz Augusta into the tunnel and he tried to cremate me, I said. I managed to get away. The rats weren't so lucky. Benny finished off the first cannoli and took a second.
Trust me, if Lou really wanted to kill you, you'd be dead. He was probably just playing around.
So you know about the tunnel?
We all know about the tunnel. It's been there for years. I used it a bunch of times. We had plans to make improvements, but never got around to it.
Is that where Jimmy hid the treasure?
In the tunnel? Nah, there's nothing down there but dirt.
I don't get why the keys are so important. If you know where the treasure is kept, why don't you just get it some other way, a locksmith or something?
I knew there was a catch to the cannoli,
Benny said.
You want to know about the treasure, right?
I'm curious.
The freaking thing is booby-trapped. You try to get at the treasure without using both keys, and it'll look like Hiroshima. Stupid idea.
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
Where'd you get these? Italian bakery? I can always tell. Best cannoli in Jersey. It's the ricotta they use.
Hiroshima is big.
No shit, excuse my French. Nobody ever thought the keys would get lost. Jimmy was keeper of the keys, and he was supposed to always have the keys with him.
Benny ate half of another cannoli.
The keys weren't on or in Jimmy, so that means your granny has them. It's the only explanation. She was with him when he checked out. We looked everywhere. We x-rayed his corpse. He should rest in peace.
This treasure must be worth a lot of money. He finished the third cannoli.
Let's just say I could retire real nice on it.
And you know where it is?
Not exactly. I got a clue. All six of us got a clue.
Why such an elaborate scheme to protect the treasure? Benny shrugged.
We can't be trusted. We're all killers. We got no sense of remorse. I mean, it's not like any of us would kill for no reason. We gotta have a good reason. Like it would have to be a job or something.
Or a treasure. There were three cannoli left in the box.
I'm gonna eat just one more,
Benny said.
And yeah, like a treasure. It was put away as a kind of retirement fund, mostly because it was too hot to fence when we got it. I'll tell you what my clue says, but it wouldn't do you no good since you don't have the keys, right?
Right.
Besides, that would be too much information for just a box of cannoli. More information would have to be moving into the sexual favors area.
Ew, I said. Get real. Benny scooped a glob of cannoli filling off his shirt.
I just said that for old time's sake. I wanted to see how it would feel.
So, how did it feel?
Not as good as I remember. I was something in my day. You won't tell my wife, will you?
No, I won't tell her. You should share the last cannoli with her.
Maybe,
Benny said. One last question, and I think I already know the answer. Obviously, someone knows the location of the treasure.
The guy who stashed it away,
Benny said. The keeper of the keys?
Bingo, you got it. Jimmy. He was a guy we all trusted. He hid the treasure a bunch of years ago and gave us our clues. He even gave himself a clue. He got the last clue. I'm thinking it probably was the combination for the lock. You gotta stick the keys in, and then you need the combination.
And now he's dead.
Yeah, dumb fuck. Who would have thought he'd go like that?
When someone dies, what happens to his clue?
The clues get put in the molehole safe, if we can find him. It was like a ritual. We drank some whiskey, we talked about old times, we spit on the floor and put the clue in the molehole safe.
Why did you spit on the floor?
Men do these things. Like I said, it was a ritual, like retiring the dead SOB's chair.
He looked at the two cannoli left in the box.
I might have to eat these.
Three of the six treasure owners have died, I said, and I'm guessing you only have two clues in the safe.
I'm guessing Jimmy's clue is missing, along with the keys.
I'm not saying, but you could be right. Look, here's the deal. The clues were more like a fun game. Truth is, if we wanted to find the treasure, we could. We could just put all our clues together. And besides, some of the guys probably followed Jimmy and figured it out. I couldn't be bothered. For that matter, we could have gotten the keys from Jimmy if we really wanted. All we had to do was kill him. None of us did any of this, because the treasure was basically worthless hours after we got it. It was hotter than hot. The booby trap was set so the treasure would be destroyed if someone got stupid greedy before enough time had passed.
Has enough time passed? I asked. Benny shrugged.
Hard to say.
Leaving Benny with cannoli crumbs and powdered sugar on his shirt, I let myself out and drove to the office. As far as bail bonds offices go, this one's okay, but it's not going to get a spread in Architectural Digest. It's basically a storefront. The front room has an ugly brown naugahyde couch against one wall, and two uncomfortable plastic orange chairs are positioned in front of a large metal desk on the other side of the room. A bank of rarely used file cabinets line the back wall. There's storage in the room behind the file cabinets, and a coffee station just inside the rear exit. My cousin Vinny hides out in a private office located behind the metal desk. Anyone wanting to beat the crap out of Vinny has to get around the desk and through his locked door. Connie Rizzoli, the office manager, sits behind the desk and keeps a loaded Glock 9 in her bottom drawer. Vinny is an excellent bail bondsman, but a slimeball in every other aspect of his life. Hence, the security precautions. Connie looked up from her computer when I walked in. She's a couple years older than me and a much better shot. She'd be a dead ringer for Dolly Parton if only Dolly had black hair and a mustache.
I have three failure to appear files for you, Connie said to me. One of them is a high bond. Vinny is going to be all over you to bring him in.
If you get arrested and don't want to sit in jail until the court decides your ultimate fate, you pay my cousin to put up a bond for your release. If you don't show up for your court date and disappear off the face of the earth, Vinny is out his bond money. If this happens too many times, not only is Vinny in the red, but his father-in-law will amputate Vinny's penis. It's my job to make sure the ifs never get to the penis removal point. I make my money by finding the failure-to-appear idiots for Vinny and dragging them back to jail. Currently, I was in desperate need of money. Rent was due, and I was 2 days away from searching the bottom of my bag for spare change. Lula was on the couch. She'd changed her clothes, and she'd added pink glitter to her eyelids for some afternoon glam.
I already went through the files, she said. We got a good one. George Potts. Remember him? He made national news a couple months ago when he got arrested for streaking down Hamilton Avenue and using the sidewalk in front of Tasty Pastry Bakery as a bathroom. He blamed it on bad weed and a gluten allergy.
I looked at the other two. Arnold Rugalowski, one of the fry cooks at Cluck in a Bucket, was caught on camera putting fried roaches in his ex-wife's bucket of clucky chicken. She was insisting it was attempted murder, and he said it was a hate crime. The third FTA was the high bond. Rodney Trotter had been giving silicone butt implants in the back of his 15-year-old VW bus. His slogan was, "We come to you and you get what you want." After numerous complaints and an almost death, he was arrested for practicing butt enhancement without a license. The court set a six-figure bond because it deemed Trotter a high risk for flight.
You look like a balloon someone just let the air out of, Lula said to me. Are you okay?
The human race is doomed, I said. How can we survive when the earth is populated by people like this?
These people aren't so bad, Lula said. I've known lots worse. You gotta look at their whole picture. The tasty pastry pooper was probably just trying to get happy with weed and a supermarket birthday cake, and it didn't work out for him. The cook at Cluck in a Bucket fried the roaches. It's not like he was feeding them to his ex-wife while they were alive or something. And I don't know what to say about the butt injector. He shouldn't have been doing that. Anyways, the good news is that we're going to drag their sorry asses back to jail where they'll have a chance to rehabilitate themselves.
Do you really think serving time could help them? I asked Lula.
Hell no, she said. They'll get gang raped and hooked on meth.
Connie held a half-empty box of donuts out to me.
This is why I get a box of donuts every morning, she said. It's a box full of happiness.
I took a donut and shoved the files into my messenger bag. I'm all about happiness.
Me too, Lula said. We should probably take the box with us in case our happiness runs out. We're going out after the bad guys, right?
Right. Chapter 4 Lula followed me out of the office with a donut box under her arm.
Who's up first?
Rodney Trotter.
Going after the big money,
Lula said.
I like your style.
No guts, no glory, I said. Your car or mine?
I'm thinking you should drive on account of I just had my baby detailed. In case we get around to the streaker and he still has gluten issues, I wouldn't want him in my back seat if you see what I'm saying.
Lula drove a red Firebird that she kept in pristine condition. When she had her sound system cranked up, it was enough to make birds fall out of the sky and your molars explode. I got behind the wheel of the CRV and handed the Trotter file over to Lula.
It says here that he lives on Stiller Street, Lula said. That's across town by the public housing projects.
I was having a hard time focusing on Trotter. My brain was stuck on Benny and the treasure. I drove over the railroad tracks and turned right toward the train station.
We're going the wrong way, Lula said. You must be taking the scenic route.
I want to ride past the molehole. It's not that much out of the way.
What do you expect to see there?
I don't know. Probably nothing.
Are we going in?
Lula asked. Do you think we should?
I wouldn't mind. We could get some of those curly cheese fries. We left in a hurry this morning. You were all worried about what's his name?
Luis Augusta. I was half a block from the molehole, and Lula leaned forward in her seat.
Look who's coming out of the titty bar, she said. It's a crazy woman that went down into the tunnel.
I pulled to the side of the street and idled.
She doesn't look singed or anything, Lula said. Her hair isn't smoking. Hard to tell from this distance, but her shoes don't even look muddy.
The woman walked through the parking lot and got into a black Mercedes sports car. She pulled out of the lot, and I followed her.
You think she's got something to do with the treasure? Lula asked.
I don't know. I think it's weird that she mysteriously showed up and went down into the tunnel.
Yeah, who does that with her Fendi backpack and Louboutins? Those Louboutins didn't even look like knockoffs. They looked like they were made out of real quality leather.
The Mercedes took a right turn, drove two blocks, and took another right. It sailed through a yellow light, and I got the red.
I think she made you, Lula said.
Yep.
Not her first rodeo, Lula said.
Yep again. 20 minutes later, I was on Stiller Street. Narrow, two-story red brick row houses lined both sides of the street for three blocks. The brick was grimy with age. Paint was blistered and peeling on window trim. Front yards were postage stamp size, and most were neglected. It was easy to find Trotter's house. His van was parked at the curb.
This isn't much of a neighborhood for a doctor, Lula said. You'd think he'd have a nicer house. I'm guessing he does a lot of pro bono butt jobs.
He isn't a doctor, I said, parking behind the van. He's a con man.
Even more reason why he should have a certain lifestyle. He doesn't have any overhead. He just has a lame-ass van to service. And he doesn't have to buy malpractice insurance. He probably doesn't have to fill out any Medicare forms either, since it's a questionable cosmetic procedure.
Lula and I crossed the small yard. I rapped on Trotter's front door, and a woman answered. Hard to tell her age. Somewhere between 50 and infinity. Her face was deeply lined and artificially tanned. Her lips looked like they might explode at any minute. A self-rolled joint was stuck between the lips. She was wearing flip-flops and a magenta tent dress that came to mid-calf. Mrs. Trotter? I asked.
Yep.
I'm looking for Rodney. I'd like to speak to him.
He's in the kitchen having a late lunch.
The living room was dark and cluttered. Too much furniture. Stacks of newspapers. Giant box-store-sized jars of snacks. Pretzel nuggets, dill pickles, Hershey miniatures, popcorn, Twizzlers, Cheetos, beef jerky. A gruesome collection of taxidermied animals. Squirrels, cats,
foxes, skunks, a small pig, a weasel.
The snack jars I get, Lula said. But what's with the creepy dead animals?
Rodney says taxidermy relaxes him after a hard day of surgery, the woman said. It's his hobby.
The kitchen was just as cluttered as the living room. Boxes of cereal were stacked on the counters beside jugs of vinegar, family-sized jars of peanut butter, badly stuffed rodents with their teeth bared, loaves of bread, and bags of cookies. A thin man with balding black hair and excessively bloodshot eyes was at the kitchen table. He was wearing a tight, silky black shirt, and he was drinking Jose Cuervo tequila without benefit of a glass or straw.
Hey, sweetie, he said, eyeing Lula. You looking for a booty job? I got an opening this afternoon, soon as I'm done with lunch.
First off, I'm not your sweetie, Lula said. Second, do I look like I need any work? My booty is perfect, just like the rest of me. And even if I wasn't perfect, I wouldn't let a drunk punk ass like you touch me.
Sticks and stones, he said.
Rodney Trotter? I asked.
Yeah, how about you, cutie? You looking to get beautified? I got a special going this week on lips.
He squinted at the woman.
Hey, Ma, show her your lips.
His mother did duck lips at me and shuffled off into the living room.
I could give you lips like that, Trotter said.
Gee, hard to pass up, but no, I told him. I'm looking to take you downtown to reschedule your court date.
No can do. I got a big day ahead of me.
His eyes rolled back in his head. He fell off his chair and crashed to the floor.
Huh, Lula said. You think he's dead?
Not yet, I said. I think he passed out from too much lunch.
This man should not be practicing medicine, Lula said. He's a mess. He shouldn't even be practicing fake medicine.
Mrs. Trotter, I yelled, we have a problem. The woman came into the kitchen and looked down at Rodney.
Sometimes he takes a nap after lunch, she said.
We could drag him out, throw him into your back seat, and turn him over to the police, Lula said to me. Problem is, the police might not want him, being that he's unconscious. They've been getting picky about that lately.
I pulled cuffs out of my back pocket. We can secure him and let him sleep it off at the office. I reached for his wrist. His eyes blinked open, and he scrambled away from me.
That was a short nap, Lula said.
Get away from me, Trotter said. I know my rights. I'm a doctor.
You aren't no doctor, Lula said, and you got no rights. You signed them away when you got bonded out of jail.
Trotter lurched to his feet and grabbed a large syringe off the kitchen counter.
One step closer and I'll inject you.
What the hell is that? Lula asked. It looks like something you'd use on a horse.
Tools of the trade, he said. I can work miracles with this baby.
This is ridiculous, I said. Put the syringe down.
Get out of my house as someone gets us in their face, he said. I'll make your nose look like it should be a balloon in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
You want me to shoot him? Lula asked.
No, I said. We don't shoot people.
Sometimes we shoot people, Lula said.
Not this time. He isn't armed.
He looks armed to me, Lula said. He's threatening to rearrange my nose with butt filler.
Don't get too close to him, I said. Let me handle this.
How are you going to handle it? You going to let him pump up your nose? I'll tell you how I'm handling it. I'm leaving. If I can't shoot him, then I'm out of here. Adios. Au revoir. Sayonara.
Lula and I backed out of the kitchen, not taking our eyes off Trotter. We hurried through the living room, left the house, and jumped into my car. Okay, Stephanie, I told myself. So this wasn't your finest hour, but you'll have another chance to capture him. It's all about dogged perseverance, right?
That was a disappointing experience, Lula said. I need to elevate my endorphins. I'd say we go after the cluck-in-a-bucket fry cook on account of I could try out those new donuts everyone's talking about. They're calling them chicken nuts because they fry the dough in the same oil as the fried chicken. I'm thinking some of those chicken nuts could take my endorphins to a whole new level. Besides, it's a real innovation in the world of fast food frying, and you know I'm all about innovating.
I pulled away from the curb. Onward to the chicken nuts.
Chapter 5 Cluck in a Bucket is 5 minutes from the bail bonds office on a good day. 10 minutes if church is getting out or if there's a funeral procession leaving the funeral home on Hamilton. It was 20 minutes from Trotter's house. We got to Cluck in a Bucket after the lunch rush and before the dinner rush. There were a few cars in the parking lot, no cars in the drive-through line.
"I'm feeling good about this," Lula said. "This is going to be a win-win. We capture the fry cook, and we get chicken nuts as a bonus."
I'd be happy with just a win. I wasn't sold on the chicken nuts. I parked the car and got out and arranged my gear. Cuffs in Jean's right-hand back pocket. Car keys in Jean's left-hand back pocket. Pepper spray in right-hand sweatshirt pocket. Fake badge and legitimate right to apprehend papers in left sweatshirt pocket. Illegal stun gun left in car. Cell phone and credit card in sports bra. Lula kept her equipment in her purse. Lula rarely had pockets.
"Things could happen fast after we start the apprehension process with Arnold," Lula said. "So I'm suggesting we get our chicken nuts first. I'll just step up like I'm an ordinary customer, and then as soon as I get my nuts, we can make our move."
She fished her wallet out of her purse.
"What kind of nuts do you want, regular or extra spicy?"
"I'm gonna pass on the nuts."
"What? No nuts? You gotta try the nuts. It's just wrong not to try the nuts."
"I'm not in the mood for nuts."
"This is about that fight you had with Morelli, isn't it? It's the Nuts Association."
"That's ridiculous. It's not about Morelli, and it's definitely not about his, you know."
"His nuts."
"Yes, his nuts. It's not about his nuts. Morelli's nuts are just fine. Thank you."
"Well, you gotta miss them."
"Could we please move on from this?"
"Just saying," Lula said.
I caught a look at Lula and decided my chances of walking away with no nuts were small to none. "Okay," I said, "I'll try the chicken nuts. I want the plain."
"Yeah, but it's all about the extra spicy," Lula said.
I felt my eyes narrow and my teeth clench. "Then get me the extra spicy."
"Good choice," Lula said. "I'll be right back."
I hung just inside the door while Lula went to the counter. Lula was right. I missed Morelli. I missed his dog, Bob. I missed his big screen TV. I missed the comfort and security of being in a relationship. I missed hearing about his day and cuddling next to him in bed at night. I missed his playful sexiness and the heat that came with the play. I wanted to end the standoff, but I didn't know how to resolve the problem that caused the argument. When Grandma found the keys, I told her I'd help her find the treasure. From that moment on, it's been a battlefield with Grandma and me on one side and the rest of my family plus Morelli on the other side. All of their objections are valid. Ownership of the treasure isn't clear. Much of the search will most likely fall into the gray zone of legality. And there are psychopaths involved, so it will be dangerous. Maybe even fatal. Morelli's parting shot was that he didn't want a relationship with Indiana Jones. Okay, I get that, because I have similar feelings about having a relationship with a cop. It's dangerous work, and the hours aren't always great. My problem is that while Morelli made the statement to get a point across, he hit on a squelched desire. I'm realizing that I'm a closet indie. For much of my childhood, I was convinced I could fly. I broke my arm trying. I wanted to be Wonder Woman, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Princess Leia. None of that worked out for me. I ended up selling bargain basement lingerie when I graduated from college, and now I'm tracking down a man who fried roaches and fed them to his ex-wife. Transitioning into Indiana Jones has a lot of appeal. Indy never had to eat chicken nuts to save the day. Monkey brains, yes, but not chicken nuts. Lula put her order in for extra spicy nuts and waited at the counter. A couple of minutes later, the counter girl handed Lula a giant bucket of nuts, and Lula motioned for me to step forward.
"I can take it from here," Lula said to me. "I know I'm just the assistant agent, but I got a good grip on this one."
She popped a donut into her mouth and looked like she was in rapture.
"Oh my God," she said. "This is the best donut ever. This is like having an orgasm in my mouth, and not someone else's either, like it's mine."
The counter girl took a step back.
That's gross.
Well, obviously you don't know a lot about orgasms, Lula said. I gotta talk to the fry cook. I gotta compliment him.
He's in the back, the girl said. He's pretty busy right now.
Hey, fry cook, Lula yelled. I gotta talk to you.
A big guy in a grease-stained white t-shirt appeared and stepped up to the counter. He was over 6 feet tall and built like a bear. He was balding, and the hair he had left was pulled into a ponytail. He had a 2-day beard and bloodshot eyes.
You got something to say about my nuts?
He asked Lula. Lula looked back at me.
Is he the one?
She whispered. I nodded yes.
Are you Arnold Rugalowski? Lula asked.
Yeah,
he said.
So what?
Lula tucked the bucket of nuts under her arm and fished around in her purse.
Hold on, she said. I gotta get my equipment.
Lula's purse had the capacity of a small suitcase. Lula could never find anything in her purse. Maybe I can help, I said, moving closer, offering Lula my cuffs.
Thanks, Lula said, taking the cuffs, turning to Arnold. We're bond enforcement agents, and we want you to come downtown with us so we can reschedule your court date.
Screw that,
Arnold said.
And you're not getting my nuts either.
He reached across the counter and grabbed the cardboard bucket Lula had tucked under her arm.
Hey, Lula said, those are mine. I paid for them.
Arnold flipped her the bird and walked back to his fry station.
That's rude, Lula said. I don't like his attitude. I want to see the manager, she said to the counter girl. I demand to see the manager.
He isn't here right now, she said. It's just me and Arnold. Do you want to talk to Arnold again?
Damn right I want to talk to Arnold,
Lula said.
Hey, Arnold, she yelled. Get your butt out here and bring my nuts with you.
Arnold stepped up to the counter.
You want your nuts? Try this on for size.
He took a donut from the bucket and threw it at Lula. It hit her in the forehead and was followed by a second that hit her left boob.
Ow, Lula said. Stop that.
Make me,
Arnold said. Lula fished around in her purse, found her Glock, and fired off a shot that took out an overhead sign advertising Clucky Nuggets. The counter girl ducked behind the counter, and a handful of people who had been sitting in booths ran out of the building. Arnold reached under his greasy t-shirt and grabbed the gun he had tucked under his waistband.
Dumb fat bitch, he said. Eat this.
Lula shrieked, panicked, and threw her gun at him, and we ran for the car. Arnold unloaded a couple of rounds that missed Lula and me, but took out my side mirror. I chirped the tires getting out of the lot and headed for the office.
He said I was fat, Lula said. Can you imagine?
That's what bothers you about that whole fiasco?
That's not all. I'm bothered that I never got my chicken nuts, even though the one I ate didn't live up to my expectations.
What about the orgasm in your mouth?
I suppose you never lied about an orgasm. I was being complimentary. And I'll tell you another thing. They should do something about gun control in this state. They let just any batshit crazy idiot carry a gun.
You carry a gun, I said.
That's different. I'm almost a police officer. I'm a quasi-law enforcement person.
You realize you left your gun back there?
Yeah, I'm going to have to replace it. I'll detour to the hair salon on Stark when I go home today. Lolita Sue always has a nice collection. I get all my guns from her.
You don't get them at a gun shop?
Hell no. You got to fill out all those forms and go through a bunch of crap. All I do with Lolita Sue is give her a couple bucks.
I dropped Lula at the office, and I called Ranger.
I need you, I said to him.
Babe, Ranger said. I'm your man.
I don't need you that way. I need you to help me break into a safe.
Okay, that was sort of a fib. Every woman I knew lusted after Ranger, including me. He was 6 feet of hard-muscled perfection. He was magic in bed, and he had a magnetic pull that was beyond the physical. On the flip side, he wasn't a candidate for marriage, and he had a code of conduct that didn't necessarily conform to the national norm. I decided a while ago that it was best to ignore and deny Ranger lust.
I have a lot of skills, Ranger said. Safe-cracking isn't one of them.
But you know someone.
I do.
I'm on the hunt for the Lazy Boy's treasure. Supposedly there are clues locked up in the safe at the Mole Hole.
There's a little Italian bakery on Henry Street,
Ranger said. Carlotta's.
Meet me in the lot behind the bakery at 10 o'clock tonight.
Okay, but... The man of mystery disconnected. I thought about the files in my bag. Potts, Rugalowski, and Trotter. It was mid-afternoon. I could make another try at a capture. Potts was the obvious choice. He was guilty of a non-violent crime, and he was a first offender, so he wasn't up to speed on the system. When I told him that I was merely taking him downtown to get a new court date, he might actually believe me. There was the gluten issue, but he'd probably have clothes on, so an accident wouldn't be an entire disaster. Plus, I kept a shower curtain in the back for blood and other body fluid emergencies. My bounty hunter skills are lacking, but at least I'm prepared for fugitive leakage. Chapter 6. Potts was 37 years old and living with his parents in a house on Porter Street. A spouse wasn't listed on his bond application. His parents put up the bail bond money. He was unemployed. Porter Street was about a mile from the bonds office in a neighborhood very much like the Berg. Small houses, non-existent front yards, and backyards big enough to hold a Weber grill and a trash can. Mostly blue-collar, two-income families or retirees who had paid off their mortgage. I parked across from the Potts house and watched for a while. A Ford Escape was in the driveway that led to a single-car garage. A rusted-out Sentra was at the curb. I was guessing everyone was home. Not my favorite scenario. I hated to make apprehensions that involved parents. It always felt sad that they had to see their kid led away in cuffs.